this week on Art of the Air, our whole show features the storied career of Chicago-based photographer, storyteller, and former public relations executive Tom Duty, whose work spans three decades, including his recent soiree into war-torn Ukraine. Our spotlight's on LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra's Holiday at the Pops concert on December 13th under the baton of Dr. Carolyn Watson.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight once again from the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra and the Executive Director, Emily Yannis. And she's going to tell us all about the holiday concert coming up. But we also want to just maybe chat a little bit about the concert they just had. I think that's the first actual subscription concert. And she talked about that before. But welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight, Emily.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, always nice to see you.
So how was your first season concert? That was on November 8th, the Dream of America concert. So that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it was a great kickoff to our season celebrating America's 250th birthday. So it was just fabulous. Our seven actors did a great job portraying the immigrants from Ellis Island. And we're really looking forward to the rest of the season and celebrating America's birthday with the remaining subscription concerts we have.
Right. And now, before we get into the upcoming concert, have you had any other little events, you have a special group, I can't remember what you call it, but kind of like a supporters of the symphony where you have those things.
Friends of the Symphony.
Yeah.
Yeah, and absolutely. Thanks for asking about that. Yes, our Friends of the Symphony is an active group of people who gather three, four times a year, so quarterly, for a luncheon, and they do some advocacy for the symphony and some fundraising. And we recently had a special Veterans Day celebration on November the 11th that we celebrated with music, and some folks from the History Museum did a presentation. And so it was just a great Veterans Day celebration. And those folks are just really great advocates for our symphony out in the community. And we welcome you to come and check them out on our website, lcso.net. We have a page devoted to them and shows the schedule of luncheons for the year.
And speaking of that, you and Tim are performing or have performed like a little mini concert at some
That's
point.
That's right. We sure did. Back in October. Yeah, we did an evening of Andrew Lloyd Webber. It was hugely successful. Great turnout. Also a fundraiser for the symphony. Tim and I have a lot of fun singing together, and it was great to sing the Phantom of the Opera duet with him.
With the holiday concert coming up, let's talk a little bit about that, what we can expect to hear. I know this is I think your biggest turnout concert because of it. So tell us a little bit about the upcoming concert.
Sure, that's right. Yes, holidays, very popular time to go to the symphony, and everyone just really loves the festive atmosphere at the Civic Auditorium. And We are just so excited to once again usher in the holiday season with a program of fantastic music. We've got some special Charlie Brown Christmas, some familiar favorites, Illumination, our vocal group is going to join us again for some numbers. The electric violins will make another appearance as they did last year. That was a big favorite. And of course, we'll end with the Silent Night sing-along that everyone always loves so much and that really kind of caps off the evening and makes everybody leave with a warm feeling and ready to celebrate the holidays.
Oh, completely.
And so that one, I know we've talked about the capacity before, and of course they've renovated the Port Civic Auditorium, but what's your capacity for that with tables and the balcony seating?
That's right. Yeah, our floor tables have sold out, so that is completely sold out. So the balcony seating, there's almost 1,200 seats up there, and they are very comfortable, wonderful padded seats with cup holders. And lots more railings and safety supports up there, so easier for people to maneuver. And so we encourage you to get a ticket for the balcony, $25 for adults, $10 for kids, and those are online at lcso.net. We want to pack that balcony as full as we can.
Is there a special treat, like maybe the guy in the red suit showing up?
Sure, but you might see some Santa hats. Oftentimes our string basses will have a Santa hat at the end of their string bass, which I always love to see.
Are there many children that do attend the holiday Pops
yes.
concert?
Yes, there are a lot of children. A lot of families make this their annual tradition. So it's very, very family friendly. We try to keep it under 2 hours, more like an hour and a half in length. Short intermission, but there's going to be lots of sweet treats for sale, and there will be lots of festive atmosphere, some caroling in the lobby as people walk in. So it's definitely something for the whole family.
Skipping ahead just a little bit, keeping with the America theme, your concert after this one in February, tell us about that.
That's right. February 7th will be at LaPorte High School in their lovely auditorium, recently renovated. And we have a jazz program, the Roaring Twenties, celebrating America's jazz age. We have a fabulous singer coming in, a Memphis-based vocalist named Rebecca Howell, who specializes in this music. She's going to sing some Gershwin, some Cole Porter, lots of familiar favorites. And the orchestra will, of course, be playing lots of tunes. And I think it's just going to be a really fabulous toe-tapping time. If you love the jazz age, come on out. Even if you don't love the jazz age, I think this concert will turn you around. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Maybe right. Come in costume?
Yeah, why not? I bet some of our board members will. We have one particular board member who loves a costume. So put on your flapper dress and your zoot suit and come on out.
Yeah.
It sounds like a great evening. And I know you have more concerts. We're going to talk about those later in the American theme, like one every month up at the March That's and right. February. So quickly, review us the dates and times about the holiday concert.
Yes, just one night only, Saturday, December 13th, 7 o'clock p.m. at the LaPorte Civic Auditorium. Doors open at 6. There will be food and beverage for sale. Tickets online at lcso.net. You also can purchase tickets at the door.
Sounds great. We appreciate you coming on Art of the Air Spotlight. That's Executive Director Emmy Giannis, and she's at the LaPorte County Symphony. And again, Holiday at the Pops, December 13th at LaPorte Civic Auditorium. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Janet Davies, formerly of ABC7 and now the Dunes Arts Foundation, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Tom Duty to Art on the Air. Tom is a Chicago-based photographer, storyteller, and former PR executive whose work spans 3 decades across media, hospitality, and the arts. A former nightclub and hospitality owner in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Mexico, he has spent much of his life in environments where culture, community, and personal transformation intersect. Photography began in his early 20s, and his photographic career since 2021 has focused on architectural and environmental imagery. Tom speaks openly about his 36-year sobriety, a recovering alcoholic and addict, and the impact it has had on his worldview. Recently, he traveled to the Ukraine to document the people and their day-to-day lives, the survival, dignity, humor, grief, and hope. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Tom. Wonderful, wonderful meeting you.
Hi, Esther. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, we enjoy having our guests on the show and someone like you. And we want our audience to get to know your backstory first. I call it your origin story. So tell us about how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Thanks, Larry. It's been a strange and circuitous journey. I started out on the South Side, only child, son of, nice conservative Irish Catholic parents, and started out in what is now known as Chirac, which at the time was Auburn and Gresham, which was at the time a very pretty narrow ethnic mix of Irish, Italian, Polish, and I was a product of the Chicago Catholic school system. I'm a slowly recovering Catholic. And I grew up a lot in my own head. I was always a creative. I knew I was a creative. I was into music. I was into fashion at a very young age, which is kind of an anomaly on the South Side of Chicago for, a young boy. And, I was an outsider. I had very few friends. I didn't fit into the sports thing and the peer thing. I was bullied relentlessly, and I mean brutally bullied. And the South Side is kind of a rough place to grow up, or it certainly was when I was coming up, and that definitely had quite an impact on me. It shaped me. I didn't really know how much it had shaped me until, I really turned some of that ground over, retrospectively much later on. But I was an outsider until I was about 13, 14. Then I started drinking and doing drugs. And I was the first kid on my block to smoke pot and to have hair below his earlobes. And I was about 2 years ahead of the curve. It seems I've kind of been on the bleeding edge of every movement from hippiedom in 1968, 69 to punk rock 79 to EDM today to everything. But I was shunned. And when I started, getting high, I found my tribe. And, I was suddenly I was cool. I was popular. I was a couple of years ahead of the curve of everybody else on the South Side. I was ostracized by my family until a couple of years later, and they'd sidle up to me at a wedding or a funeral and say, "Hey, man, you got any of that grass that, and suddenly I was cool and I was in demand. And, that was a life changer, very, very intoxicating for me. And that was a time when, the drugs and alcohol, as they say, were still working for me. I had a wonderful time. I hitchhiked around the country. I was, up until about, I'd say about 18, 19, things were great. And then, as they say, the fun became interlaced with problems, and then there was less fun and more problems. And at about 23 years old, I got into the nightclub business, and I got into it through punk rock. I had been on the vanguard of that. I'd been introduced to some music early on in like 77. And when a couple of clubs started to open in Chicago, I was drawn to them. And so I ended up managing a series of nightclubs in Chicago that were at a very seminal time in music between 79 and, for me, that went through 89. But clubs like Smart Bar, Metro, Neo, later Limelight, the common thread throughout all of those were they were embraced by everybody that was looking for what was new, what was, you know, what was imported, what was non-derivative of other music at the time. And I another common thread is that they were all sanctuaries. You know, particularly neo when I started, it was gay people, it was straight people, it was black, white, you know, whatever. People could dance on the dance floor by themselves. Men could dance with men. Women could dance with women. And there was a big straight audience. So it was a real melting pot of different cultures. And I think that was very protective of that. And all of the nightclubs that I was involved in, having been bullied the way that I was for being an outsider, you know, I had a sense of what that felt like. And, you know, I think, you know, fast forwarding to that, you know, just jumping ahead to, you know, Ukraine, I watched what was happening there, and I watched what was happening to the people. And, you know, this big bully bear that came in and, you know, started to take their country away from them. So that was something that, you know, I kind of checked in with myself and I was like, yeah, you know, that was one of the inspirations for me, I think. But I got sober in 1989, and concurrent with that, I started a PR firm. I had been doing media relations and event management at Limelight, which is out of New York, and it was the biggest of the big clubs that came into Chicago, and very event-driven, very celebrity-driven. And I thought I knew a lot more about PR and media relations than I actually did. I only knew it from a nightclub perspective, and I only knew it from having several external agencies that I worked with while I was there. And but I had a Rolodex, and I wasn't shy, and I'd call people up and tell them I wanted to represent them, that I wanted to handle their media, and, you know, started picking up clients. So anyway, that agency grew over a period of 10 years to employ 30 people and bill, you know, $6-7 million a year, which for, you know, a small agency is significant. And I tired of PR. I started to become more cognizant of the manipulation of reality element of it. And, you know, with the internet coming into popularity and as a news medium, I didn't feel as good as I did about it at one time. Once I got over the fact that I could take a conversation in a conference room and turn it into a major news story, it started to feel a bit shallow to me. So the agency merged into a big ad agency. I had a 2-year commitment, and then I decided to move to Mexico and open a big nightclub on the beach in Playa del Carmen.
You know, I found this kind of blurb about you in 1986, yeah, which said you were the most, like, they weighed in on who do you want the most at your party? Who is the number one person? And that was you. And it talked about the Arama motorcycle crew.
Yeah. Yeah, who is Marlene Krigowski, who has Gag Gallery now, that is also a friend of Marla's, and our mutual friend. And I actually went to an opening at her little home gallery thing that she's created the night before last. But yeah, I was officially the coolest guy in Chicago one night in 1986, and it's been downhill ever since. But
I don't think that.
Yeah, we were at the center of the scene, and you know, we were just happened to be at the right place, the right time. It seems all the time. You know, when the musicians that became, you know, arena sized popular in the 90s and forward, they were all coming up when they were playing at Metro. They were, you know, they were coming to Neo. David Bowie came in, you know, from just a whole array. I couldn't even list the number of bands that Joe Shanahan and Metro did their first Chicago appearance. And Metro is a beautiful 900 capacity venue with great sound, old proscenium stage. And, it, you know, 3 or 4 nights a week, it was from punk 2.0 to industrial to hip hop to, you know, we covered, you know, virtually every genre in its, you know, in its infancy. So it was, I was at the center of it, Limelight particularly. If you know anything about that club, you know, it grew out of New York, where it was, you know, at the center of, you know, that cultural moment, and had a club in London as well. And that was my introduction to, you know, a globally important nightclub experience.
How did you somersault from Neo to Limelight, and where does Smart Bar fit in?
Neo was from 79 to 82. I got fired the first, I started bartending there. I lied my way into bartending, and I got fired for doing too many Quaaludes too frequently. And I went away for about 6 months, and I sobered up a little bit. I think I'd quit drinking for a period of time. I was diagnosed with pancreatitis in my early 20s. Which I kept drinking for another 11 years after that. But I had gotten fired, and I had gone to another little club, the 950. And I had pulled a lot of the clientele with me. And Neo had been on a bit of an ebb. And the owners came back, and they say, "Hey, Tom, you seem to have gotten your stuff together a little bit more. How would you like to come back?" And I was like, the only way I'm going to come back is if I manage it, and you know, I basically have creative control. And they said, "Done." I was stunned, and I did, and I had a great two and a half year run of managing it. And you know, again, these were the halcyon years,
right?
Certainly, as far as I'm concerned, they were. So many things were breaking and happening. Rap and hip hop were in their infancy. You know, the music that was coming in was freshest imports and compliments of Wax Trax Records,
which
was a resource in Chicago. So we were getting the freshest German, Belgium, French, Dutch music that was being made, you know, along with, you know, the American stuff. And, you know, it was just a real hotbed of musical creativity and young people playing with fashion. And, you know, it was a wonderful time. And, you know, that was... from there, I went and I took a management position at Metro and Smart Bar for Joe Shanahan, who I go back to 19 years old with. And you know, it was you know, it was all my friends. It was just a, you know, a great experience for about 3 years. And then in 1985, I got a call, and I had been under consideration. I was recruited by Peter Gation out of New York, and Peter was Limelight, and, you know, one of my greatest mentors.
It was quite a production, Limelight. I mean, the whole retrofitting of that space, and
built by Henry Ives Cobb in 1896, I believe. Incredible Gothic castle of a building. And Peter came in, and he turned it into a nightclub, just the way he had turned the New York club was a former Presbyterian church that he had converted to a nightclub, keeping a lot of the religious iconography intact. So it was, you know, great sacrilege, which I thought was really great at the time. And Limelight, you know, the general manager reached out to me, a friend of mine, Russ Bernelli, and he said, he goes, "I want to talk to you." He goes, "You know, we could really use you here." And I'm like, you know, I'm a general manager, you know, you're a general manager, you know, I don't want your job, you know. And he goes, no, we want you in the PR department. I'm like, PR department? What does a nightclub have a PR department for? He goes, "New York, understand me." He goes, you'll do fine in there. You'll figure it out right away. And I did figure it out right away. And, you know, I... went in and I carved out a little place for myself, and I started reaching out to the Chicago people, the more underground, the Wax Trax people, the DJ community, the art community, photography community, and started to invite them in, which they hadn't felt invited in by the big New York club that came to town. And so I had a great 4-year run there. I produced nearly 1,000 events. We did events 5 nights a week that had to be, they had to reach a certain bar that Peter had established, art, fashion, culture, and all kinds of weird stuff in between. We'd go from Gloria Steinem's book party that we had imported from New York, where they'd done it there, to a Hell's Angels fundraiser in 24 hours. And, you know, we did Comme des Garçons fashion, we did Matsuda, we did runway stuff. We were doing runway fashion shows once every 10 days, 2 weeks, which nobody in Chicago did. There had never been a venue for that that understood the production requirements, willing to put the money behind it. You know, that went for, you know, we had an art department with 10 to 15 people employed in it. There was no internet, so it was mailed. So we were designing four-color invitations for five different events a week.
I just don't even know when you had time to sleep, because not only do you run a club, but I mean, I know all club owners generally go clubbing after their club as well. So
yeah, you ever heard of Medusa?
Yeah, Medusa was my place.
You ever heard of Medusa, Esther?
Yes, I danced plenty.
I got the tip off on that. Yeah, we'd, from Smart Bar all the way through Limelight, you know, we'd 4 and 5 o'clock clubs, we'd close them at 4 and 5 o'clock, finish a business, grab a couple of bottles of Absolut, a couple of bottles of Cristal, quantity of, you know, blow, and, you know, head over to Medusa. We'd close Medusa at 10:30, 11:30 in the morning, and then go over to BJ's, the gay bar on Clark Street, that opened at 6:30 for the early drinking crowd. And, you know, remarkably, I survived that. I mean, when I ended my using career with a respectable opioid addiction, I was ahead of the curve with that too. I was an early adopter, and it wasn't pretty when I was done. I was 125 pounds. You know, I'm a healthy 175 now, and you know, I was truly addicted, which, you know, I had never been throughout all of my romance with drugs and alcohol. I had a lot of painful mornings and, you know, long nights, but I came to understand what addiction was. And, you know, I realized that I was either going to live or die, or somewhere in between, some miserable kind of existence where I, you know, hung on and, you know, suffered for a number of years. So, you know, I'm one of the grateful few that was blessed with that that gift of, you know, a door opened and I walked through it.
You know, and that lifestyle is very, very much to promote that. I mean, you have to feel that. And of course, as an only child, I listened to that and how you found popularity through usage. You know, that had to kind of set, until you finally probably realized, you know, this is bad for me. But yeah, it's kind of like, is that whole nightclub style, like you just described, it's got to kind of imbue you with that.
All of it was very key to my brand. I was everywhere doing everything with, you know, all the
most
people
wanted on the party list.
Yeah, right. I know. that was a friend of mine, Marla Donato, who wrote that. So take it with a grain. But yeah, I guess she did ask two or three people, to be perfectly fair. Yeah, it would, you know, my drugs and alcohol were so central to my life and my brand and my personality, my identity, everything. I would have probably been voted the least likely kid to get clean. And I had never really considered a life without, you know, all of that, you know, substance use and that being, you know, part of my social life, my creative life, everything, until, you know, that day. And
so, do you know what day it was specifically?
August 22nd, 1989. My wife at the time, Rebecca, said, she came home and she said, "You are a shadow of the man that I married," which she'd said to me multiple times before that. But for some reason, I heard it. And I said, "Well, you know, I've got a 6-bag-a-day dope habit. Maybe that has something to do with it." And she was, you know, I was very secretive and creative. And, you know, nobody knew I had that habit. I'd just been using alone. And she said, what are you going to do with it? And I gave her my keys, my wallet, and took all my clothes off. And I said, I'm going into that room and I'm going to come out. And I never want to use again. So I did. I came out 2 weeks later. It took me another week before I could walk down a flight of stairs. I almost died from the withdrawals. Had a nervous breakdown in retrospect completely. And then started the long road of
rebuilding.
Learning all the lessons that I had missed in all the semesters from 13 to 33, you know, a two-decade run. And, you know, I'd taken a shot at, you know, creative. I started shooting Polaroids in clubs. And I've recently been posting Polaroids in the Neo alumni site. And, you know, I loved it. I always wanted to be a photographer. I was, you know, at Neo, we'd have a lot of the, you know, fashion photographers come in at the time. And I grew to be friends with, you know, quite a few of them. And I always envied the creativity that they had. And honestly, the milieu that they ran in. And of course, the girls. And, you know, you wear black all the time, which I still do. That's my primary color palette. And, you know, but I just, to me, the idea of pushing a shutter and creating an image had a particular excitement.
Second,
too. I was, and Rebecca had bought me a Polaroid for Christmas. And she goes, here, take this and do something with it. I started shooting in Uptown at 4 o'clock in the morning. People on the street, everything. And, here we are today.
After a brief pause, we'll be back to our guest today, Tom Duty, on Art on the Air. Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show, whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners? Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. In return to our guest today, Tom Duty, on Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. So you embarked on a Polaroid journey into photography, so that seems like the starting point of something different. But how did you walk away from the nightclub and the PR thing altogether, or what was your transition out of that?
It wasn't even a transition. I was doing it in the clubs. I was carrying my Polaroid with me with a few packs of the 12 instant, you know, SX70, right, you know, Polaroid film. And I was really dabbling. I was always intimidated by the idea of math and chemicals when it came to photography. Those were the two things that stayed in, you know, those were the two obstacles for me to really pursuing it. So I had taught myself music. I'd built myself a 24-track studio, and I had noodled around and, you know, started making, you know, dance music and stuff. And, I thought that was going to be my creative outlet. And then I, prior to moving to Mexico, and that was in, 2001, I had gone to Colombia and I'd taken classes in Final Cut Pro, because my idea was I was going to go to Mexico and I was going to shoot documentaries. I had no idea what, but I was confident that I'd find some oddity that interests me and, you know, shoot it. So I bought a couple of three pro cams, and I went down there and, you know, had my dual screens and fast processor. And I got very busy because I owned and I was a piece of land. I was building a nightclub, 2,000 capacity nightclub, and what had been a little bar that I had discovered on my honeymoon. Made the decision to go down 6 months later, partner with the guy that owned it. And within a year, I'd bought him out, demoed the little bar right on the Caribbean in Playa del Carmen, which is just starting to come up. And I, explosion of hubris, I built this limelight on the beach and, open air, palapas, sky bar. Three DJs, helped 2,000 people. opened it and just people started coming. And, you know, it was, I had a wild 10-year run there. But the photography, you move to Mexico, you can be anything you want. You know, you can pick a new name, you can pick a career, you can pick a past, you know, you can do whatever you want and people will buy into it. And I thought, you know what, I could declare that I'm a photographer and I could just start doing it. And I wouldn't have the burden of all of these people that would say, no, Tom, you're a nightclub manager, you're a PR person, you're, you know, I didn't feel I'd be taken seriously. So I'm in Vegas on a trip. We used to fly into the States every once in a while, once I get going, and I'm playing blackjack, and I'm playing like, you know, $50, $100 hand blackjack. I've got a couple of grand. I kept going up and down and up and down. My wife went up to bed. So I'm sitting there, I'm tired. I got a couple of grand in front of me. I said to myself, I'm going to push it all out. And if I win this hand, I'm going to spend it all on a Nikon D1 and some good glass. So I pushed it out and I got dealt two aces. If you know blackjack, you get two aces, you double down.
Right.
So I doubled down and I got two base cards and I walked out with like $8,000.
Oh. So
I was at the equivalent of like, you know, Sammy's camera in Vegas up at 9 o'clock the next morning. And I went in and I bought about $8,000 worth of glass on a Nikon D1. And I started shooting everything. I was so into it. It was just, I shot people's pets. I shot people's homes. I shot landscapes. I shot Mayan graveyards. I shot street candids. I did everything for about 2 or 3 years. And I'm a complete autodidact. Everything I've ever learned, I self-teach. I can't classroom learn. You know, I was told that I was stupid. I'd never account to anything, which is common in the Catholic, you know, school system, particularly where I was from. And, you know, I never really wanted to believe him, but I kind of did believe him. And I'd go in, I'd read all my books in the first 2 weeks of each, you know, semester. And then I'd struggle to stay awake the rest of the, you know, the rest of the year. And I'd get smacked in the head and woken up and, you know, I was just really, I didn't really learn anything in school after fourth grade. So I technically have like a fourth grade education. And, but
so Tom, what did you do with those, all those photographs while you were in Mexico? So you've got this huge collection.
I've got every one of them and I had the wisdom to shoot them all raw. So, you know, all NEF files, all editable. I just did a re-edit of a series of street candids, and I started shooting Mayan cemeteries when I was there. Tremendously colorful and playful and whimsical. And so I've got them all. I've got a body of work of about probably like 20,000 images. And I don't shoot burst. I'm a single shot shooter. You know, I love just being able to frame the shot, push the button and get it. And
pick your moment.
It forces composition. I'm from that era that I had to buy like SX70 Polaroid film.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I shoot all this, you know, I'm going to have to go out and I'm going to have to spend another $14. With digital, I don't think I've ever really gotten in touch with the fact that I don't pay by the shot.
Right.
So
that used to be my rule of thumb in the film era is every press of the button was at least a dollar a shot, you know, for that and exactly. The processing. And so, yeah. And so it trained you to, you took less images, but now in digital, yeah, I might get the composition, but I'm dialing around. Okay. I'm going to change the aperture setting. You know, I might look at the image a couple different ways that way, but like, oh, I like this composition. Okay, I'm going to try that. Now I'm going to try a little more depth of field. I'm going to try a little less. Or, yeah, you're right. That's the way to go.
Yeah, and, you know, it's I'm a big Malcolm Gladwell fan. And he writes in Blink about the 10,000 hours it takes to master something. it was 10,000 hours that the Beatles played Hamburg, you know. they came out, they were good. And, you know, that's how I learned. It was all trial and error. And I liked my own work. I liked what I was shooting. I objectively, you know, I curated a lot of photography shows at Limelight. I know good photography, you know, I know mediocre photography. And I objectively thought that, you know, some of my work was good, that, you know, I had an eye, which I always had hoped that I had. I think it took me so long to do it, I was afraid I wouldn't have the eye that I thought I had. But, you know, I was rewarded with, you know, the work that I captured. And I went from a Nikon D1 to a D3 to a D5 and, you know, continued to progress with the technology. And, you know, I think a 20-year veteran on Lightroom and longer on Photoshop. And the first time I showed was, Mexico was wonderful for 7 years. And, you know, I had the biggest nightclub with, you know, the biggest cash business in Playa del Carmen, which was wonderful until the Zeta cartel moved into town. Mm-hmm. And they wanted everything I had, and I didn't want to give it to them. And I'm from the south side of Chicago. It's like, you know, we don't give up our marbles easy. But I was filled with hubris and, you know, I guess somewhat of a sense of invincibility. And I went through about 2.5 years. By this time, we had made a lot of money. We had a beautiful home. We were traveling. And I didn't want to give that up. And I went through 2.5 years, you know, with a bunch of homicidal maniacs that, you know, threatened me on a regular basis.
What year was this, Tom?
This was, they came into Playa in 2007. Okay. So I got out in 2011. So I went through three years with a variety of tactics that only a Chicago could come up with. I befriended the governor. I did everything to possibly reinforce the idea that it would be not a good value proposition for them to kidnap or kill me, which, you know, in retrospect, they're not really logical people. They're not prone to making, you know, well-informed decisions. So I was lucky, but I got out and moved to Southern California and landed in Malibu. And, you know, I started shooting. This is, you know, all new. I'm in Southern California. There's, you know, the area I was in, the Yucatan, is kind of flat. There's one flavor of jungle. And, you know, outside of the people and the cemeteries, you know, and the landscapes, there's, you know, I'd covered everything. So I started shooting, and I became interested in American wild horses. And through a brand partnership I had done, I had an equestrian company with my wife where we did full cover T-shirts of images of horses and stuff. And I had the opportunity through these people that I met at the largest sanctuary in California for wild horses to go out, and I wangled my way in to be able to go out in the field by myself and do some overnights and just go out and camp with these herds. And I went out and I stalked them. I shot them. I, you know, lived with them. I got surrounded by them. It was an incredible experience. And a show came out of that I did in Malibu at a gallery, Canvas Gallery. And, you know, that show encouraged me to go out and buy a Canon 4100 printer that I could shoot. I could print 44-inch roll prints on canvas. So 44 by 68 inches, gallery wrapped. I have another one that's in disrepair right now, and I've got to get it fixed because large format photography, you take an image and you blow it up to that size and print it high quality, and it just changes the work. It just, yeah, you know,
really, wow.
An image dominates a room. It's just a whole new thing. And, you know, now I've got a whole backlog of stuff that I visualize printing. But the problem with printing large format that big is that then, you know, it costs a fortune to frame it or gallery wrap it. So, you know, you have to be fairly judicious with your stuff. But I dream of having some big space that I could just, you know, print to my heart's content. But I continued to shoot. I shot and shot and shot all variety of things. And I went through COVID in Los Angeles. I had a couple of interesting episodes out there, a couple of near-death experiences. And after 16 months of COVID and living in a room by myself, Chicago started to look really good again. So I came back here, and I had started to shoot architectural work in California. I knew people with large venues. And so I studied and I looked at the people who had done this well and, you know, learned online and everything. And I started shooting architectural, and I got a Fuji medium format camera, GFX. So from there into Chicago, and for the last 4 years that I've been here, that's what I was really doing. I was honing my skills with architectural work. So I started to shoot for some large brokers here, fancy people's big homes, commercial spaces, lofts, you know, all kinds of stuff. I was really challenged by it, the geometry, the math involved in it, the black and white. It's all about shadow and white, you know, which all photography is to a degree, but architectural, you know, you have an inanimate still object to work with that you have to breathe some life into and really capture what the architect, you know, had visualized when it was designed. And I was doing that about 2 years ago, and a little more than that, 2022, I watched Russia march into Crimea. Were they already in Crimea, maybe? But anyway, suddenly it was real.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Ukrainian people were like, this was Putin, you know, making a play for Europe.
Sure.
And I watched this, and I was, I said to myself, I'm interested in that. I want to know more.
You're listening to our guest today, Tom Duty, on Art in the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So that was the germ that started you wanted to go to Ukraine?
I wanted to go to Ukraine. I said to my girlfriend, I said, you know, I'd really like to go there. And she knows, and she goes, don't you dare.
Uh-oh.
And then I needed some dental work. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to go to Warsaw for it. It's really cheap. And, you know, it's, you know, the trip will be self-liquidating. I've always wanted to go to Eastern Europe. And then from that, I eased into, you know, I could take a train to Kyiv, Warsaw. And by this time in my head, I had, you know, I had started to visualize, you know, what I wanted to do. And, you know, it started to create a narrative with me. And, but I think one of the triggers for me was to see the way that Zelensky was treated when he went to the White House. I'd been following what was happening to the people in the country. And he was coming to America, and he was, you know, going to, you know, kiss the ring and, you know, try and get the support and the weaponry that they needed. And I watched J.D. Vance ask him why he hadn't worn a suit to the Oval Office. And I remember the moment I watched that episode. And I'm like, you know what? This guy's a real hero. You know, he's the real deal. And here's this empty suit asking him why he didn't dress appropriately for his White House visit. And, you know, I guess I started to get mad at the way that, you know, Ukraine was being overlooked. And I mean, it wasn't completely altruistic. I was, you know, there was a photographer's interest in going there and seeing what was going on. And I didn't have any interest in you know, I'm not going to be a Salgado. I'm not going to, you know, go and, you know, record epic images of humanity. I mean, I'm, you know, I don't have that skill level. And, you know, it's other people are doing that, and they're doing it far better than I have to do in this lifetime to do in this lifetime. So the germ of an idea started me. Somehow I'll get to Kyiv, and I want to go there. Since I'd been shooting architectural, I hadn't had a Nikon camera in 5 or 6 years. So I went out and I bought a, you know, a Z camera. They're new mirrorless cameras and, you know, all new glass for it. You know, everything I knew I'd need, you know, to shoot what I wanted to shoot there. And I started looking into the logistics. And at the time, you know, it was fly into Warsaw or Krakow and then take a train directly into Kyiv. But they started bombing the trains. So by that time, I ended up having to fly into Warsaw and then into Kyshyysa, now Moldova, and then take a 13-hour bus ride into Kyiv through, you know, some pretty infested territory. And that was really the beginning of it. And I went and I started talking to people. I visited Borodyanka, I visited Bucha, Irpin, you know, the cities that had both been occupied and had been on the forefront of the resistance.
So Tom, has any of this been prearranged, like who you'll meet, or you just show up and...
I tried to get press credentialed. If I would have gotten credentialed, I tried some of my old media friends, and you know, nobody wanted to do it because there'd be liability issues. You know, there'd be if I got killed or injured, you know, I'd be on assignment for them, and it'd be a problem. So I basically was completely on my own, and you know, I just started calling people up, talking to, and going on to some online sources that are, you know, part of the Ukrainian resistance. And made some good connections. And, you know, from there, you know, I hit the ground. And I started talking to people in coffee shops. I hooked up with some military people. I got an escort into, you know, those outlying cities. And they introduced me to people that had been sitting in Borodyanka during the occupation and what had happened there.
You were welcomed.
Oh, God. I mean, you know, they're like, I didn't meet any other Americans there. At one time, Kyiv was flooded with journalists internationally. And, you know, now it's really just off the radar. And, you know, I have an app on my phone that is... I was going to show it to you, but I don't think I have it up. Everybody gets it in Ukraine. It's the air raid app. So you hear the air raid siren, and it means that there's you know, an attack on Kyiv. And I still have it on my phone, so I still get the air raids at 6 o'clock at night when it's the middle of the night in Kyiv, and there's either a ballistic missile attack, of which I went through 3 of those, and that was an experience. And you know, I ended up, I discovered the Jewish cemetery that was Biakov Cemetery and Crematorium, that was first burials were in 1790 there. And I started to study this history of oppression, that the oppression and resistance that the Ukrainian people have had throughout their lineage. And, you know, it just turned out to be an incredible experience. Now I'm back, and, you know, I want to tell the story. I mean, one of the great opportunities I saw coming on here is, you know, keep the awareness up for, this isn't going away. Kyiv got, you know, blown to hell the night before last. All their power's out. You know, people are killed. This is the equivalent of, we wake up in the morning in Chicago and Lincoln Park, West Town, and Skokie have been hit by ballistic missiles. Power is out and nobody knows when it's coming back on. That's Wednesday in Kyiv.
Wow. Well, you know, we could probably go on and on, but we unfortunately have to wrap up here. I want to give you this last moment to tell us how people can see your work with your website. Do you have any exhibitions coming up, like into December or next year?
Yeah, I'm working on two different shows. One is going to be, I've discovered this narrative between, you know, the contemporary work that I shot when I was in Kyiv and the people, and this common thread that, you know, runs through the cemeteries there. It's a bit of a mortality narrative, and the cemetery is fascinating because the history there. Now with ChatGPT, you take a photo of a tombstone, you can tell who was buried there, and it translates and everything. Website is tomdoody.com, TOMDOODY.com. And I'm up on Instagram. I'm Tom Doody Photography at Instagram. If somebody wants to be my friend, I'm the Tom Doody on Facebook.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming on the show, sharing such a life full photography, everything. Thank you for sharing that with as a guest today on Art in the Air, and we appreciate you coming on.
Larry, Esther, it was a privilege and a joy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks, Esther.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.